When the hermit made an end, in silver armor suddenly Galahad shone before us, and against the chapel door laid lance and entered, and we knelt in prayer. And there the hermit slaked my burning thirst, and at the sacring of the mass I saw the holy elements alone. But he saw ye no more? I, Galahad, saw the grail. The holy grail descended upon the shrine. I saw the fiery face as of a child that smote itself into the bread and went. And hither am I come, and never yet hath what thy sister taught me first to see, this holy thing, failed from my side, nor come covered, but moving with me night and day, fainter by day, but always in the night, blood red and sliding down the blackened marsh, blood red and on the naked mountain top, blood red and in the sleeping mirror below, blood red and in the strength of this I rode, shattering all evil customs everywhere, and passed through pagan realms and made them mine, and clashed with pagan hordes and bore them down, and broke through all, and in the strength of this come victor. But my time is hard at hand, and hence I go, and one will crown me king far in the spiritual city, and come thou too, for thou shalt see the vision when I go. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. It's Friday, March 21st, 2025. Happy equinox and happy new year. It feels like it's been a while. The Holy Grail, what is it? The phantom of a cup that comes and goes? Nay, monk, what phantom? The cup itself from which our Lord drank at the last sad supper with his own. If a man could touch or see it, he was healed at once by faith of all his ills. And that is what we'll do by faith for all our ills tonight for this winter installment of the 42 Minutes Seasonal Book Club by celebrating The Idylls of the King, published between 1859 and 1885. The Idylls of the King is a cycle of 12 narrative poems by English poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, 1809 to 1892, which retells the legend of King Arthur, his knights, his love for Guinevere, and her tragic betrayal of him, and the rise and fall of Arthur's kingdom. The whole work recounts Arthur's attempt and failure to lift up mankind and create a perfect kingdom, from his coming to power to his death at the hands of the traitor Modred. The Arthurian legend of Camelot has been told many times, but never better than Alfred Tennyson. Employing some of the most stirring and beautiful blank verse ever written, Tennyson crafted his vision of the Knights of the Round Table over the course of nearly 50 years and have dazzled readers for well over 100 years. These endlessly inspiring, enduring lines of verse are not only entertaining, but enlightening as well. The timeless Idylls will no doubt continue to enthrall mankind for centuries to come. Sweet brother, I have seen the Holy Grail. The holy thing is here. Can you see it, Zenor?
Oh, yes.
I don't know that I can, but I feel it, though. The poetry, I'm feeling it.
Yeah, I don't know if I can see it yet either. Like, there's only what? There's only Percival's sister and Galahad who could actually see it. I don't even know if Percival could see it.
She told him about it? She's like,
Yeah. She was the one who first saw it. And then she set the alarm, and then that's,
which is really interesting that in this story it's a she. What do we know Percival's sister's name?
Yeah, we do. I should have looked that up, but not offhand. No, she's in Mallory, and she's in all the other ones. I've got Mallory here. But,
you're right. And I think we talked about her last time in Mallory.
Yeah. He follows Mallory pretty closely, but there's some interesting things that he does that sort of divert from what Mallory's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, just in general, this whole thing hangs together so much better than Mallory seemed to, you know?
That's kind of my question. So, like, I was overly hard on Mallory, but I think I wasn't able to say... So I think Mallory's prose is beautiful. I just mm-hmm. think his repetition is what kills it for me. So there's a lot of jousting, and there's just so much jousting, and it wore on me. But like the language itself, I found beautiful most of the time.
Right, right. Yeah, me too.
But I struggled with the big picture in Mallory in that I didn't have the context. I think I needed like a reader's guide, a better read, like something so that I knew what was going on before I got there, because just going through it that time and I didn't get all the way through it, like we talked about, like I could see the seams, and I could sense what you were talking about, this strange timeline, like it didn't mm-hmm. make sense.
It didn't all mesh, yeah.
Right. So could you share for our listeners this both the timeline of maybe Mallory and then how it makes more sense in the Tennyson?
Yeah, I forget what I was saying about Mallory. Like, so he kind of, I forget if this is the point I was making, but he sort of diverts from the original timeline given by Geoffrey of Monmouth, right, where at the end Arthur
is he fighting the Romans at the end and becomes the emperor?
Yeah, he fights the Romans at the end. So the Romans send this delegation to Arthur's court, and they demand tribute from Arthur, and Arthur just says basically, well, you give me tribute. Like, my ancestor Constantine was the emperor of Rome at one point. So, and so basically, and then he goes to war. He refuses to give tribute, and then he goes to war with Rome. He goes to France first, takes over France, and then has a fight with the Romans. Finally, almost makes it to Rome itself, and almost is going to be the emperor. And then he hears that Modred, who he left in charge back in Britain, has taken over and has betrayed him and taken over and taken Guinevere as his queen. And so with Mallory, that fight with Rome happens at the beginning of the book. And then so he changes it, and then it's actually he's fighting Lancelot at the end. Yeah, he's fighting Lancelot in France, where Lancelot's his own kingdom is, and then Modred takes over, right? So it's kind of confusing. Like, what happened with Arthur in Rome? Like, did he become the emperor? What occurred with that?
That's interesting, because you were saying last time too that it might be that it's not Arthur that's the hero, that it's Lancelot of Mallory.
In Mallory, yeah, I'd say so. Like, Lancelot is the main character. And they have that huge section in the middle, right? Like, with Tristram too, and then Tristram is sort of the contrast with Lancelot, right? And
but you were making section. A point about how in Mallory there's the establishment of the worldly knight, which is the embodied physical knight. Mm-hmm. And he's contrasting that, like Tristram is the worldly knight, but then right. Galahad is the spiritual knight.
Yeah, that's right. But he's the fallen spiritual knight. So he really doesn't succeed. He only succeeds through his son, Galahad.
Right. Yeah.
And Galahad is the image of him, like the pure image of Lancelot. Yeah. But so
how does Tennyson do it differently then?
I think he just ties it all together in a better way. Like, he follows Mallory, and I think the Vulgate too, maybe. I'm not quite sure. He follows the Mallory in that he's fighting Lancelot at the end. It's not the Romans, right? But it just it's more condensed, right? And it follows every single story, or every single idol, I guess. In a way is connected with the previous idols, and it builds up to the climax where because of the corruption within Arthur's realm, stemming from the relationship of Lancelot and Guinevere, right? And maybe from Arthur's own sense of perfection himself, right? Like, that's the other side of it, right? But it builds and builds and builds to the point where, because of that, his whole empire, his whole kingdom collapses upon him, right? Corruption spreads from that act and then ends up ruining the Round Table. And you find that in Malory, right? But it's not as that theme comes out so strongly in Tennyson, right? Like, that's the main theme that Tennyson is focusing on. And so you're not distracted by all kinds of other things that happen within Malory.
So then, in terms of philosophy, so that's something else that I was thinking about, is like, so on a basic level, Malory is saying that the worldly knight is the most powerful knight. So, like, it's, I felt like maybe chivalry was more important in our 12th century stuff. The Malory 15th century stuff was, you know, it was really about might, you know, prowess, right?
Yeah, in a way, but he also, even within Malory, right, like, Percival has to give up the idea of being a worldly knight. Like, and he gives it
because
up
because he
end.
Was on quest of the spiritual knighthood.
Yeah. And so that's the tension too within well, it's within both, I guess, but especially you find it in Tennyson, right? It's like, well, that's a big difference actually. And in Malory, when the Holy Grail appears, he's there, yeah. Or King Arthur is there, right? And he's there when it comes down at Pentecost. And in Tennyson, for one, it's not Pentecost. It doesn't indicate that it's Pentecost, which is an interesting point. But Arthur doesn't even see it. He's not even there. He's off on a hunting trip or something, right? And so he sees the light in Camelot descending, but he hasn't reached his palace yet. And so then he gets there, and then all the knights had already taken a vow to search for the Holy Grail. And then Arthur laments and says, you've taken this holy vow, so you can't give up this vow, but I fear that this is going to end up being the destruction of the Round Table, which it basically was. And the point behind that is that the knights weren't ready for it. The corruption within, the sort of moral corruption within the Round Table had spread to such an extent that very few knights were morally equipped to and spiritually equipped to go on the quest for the Holy Grail. And so Arthur prophesies really that most of them will would die or be lost, and they were, like, at the end of that section, when the knights return from the quest of the Holy Grail, there's only a tithe of them. There's only a tenth of them that returned. And so then he has to fill the spaces of all the knights that are gone around the Round Table. And then he gets a bunch of younger knights who are, it doesn't seem like they're as noble as the older knights. And that indicates a further downfall of Arthur's court and the Round Table in Camelot.
Do you get the impression? So, like, when we're way back in the past, it's just like kind of take things on their own terms. But as we're getting nearer to our own time, so we're 19th century with this one. Yeah. It's still a while ago, you know. But do you get a sense that this is kind of like a hero's journey thing where Arthur's on this kind of wheel, the wheel of, you know, the tarot card, the
wheel
king
of fortune.
Yeah, the wheel of fortune. Or do you think Tennyson is like speaking towards certain political things?
Yeah, he's, that's a good point. Like, he dedicates this whole thing to Queen Victoria, right? And then it's after the death of her husband. I think it's Prince Selbert or something. And so, and it's bound up with the idea of the British Empire, like that last section to the Queen is talking about that. So I don't know, he's not explicit about that, but I don't know if he's making a kind of sneaky point about the end of the British Empire. Like it's, when he's writing, it's kind of right at the peak of that, right? But sort of a similar thing. Like, it's interesting too. Like, you could do a whole study on that of the connection of all of these writers from Crichton and Wolfram and Mallory and all these guys up to Tennyson, their connection with the monarchs, right, and the nobility, and how they are essentially writing for the nobility of their time, the monarchs of their time. But that's another whole, it's another whole study. Like, I don't know.
It's too bad Shakespeare didn't take his hand up with one of these, huh?
It seems like Tennyson is like, just his style. He's echoing Shakespeare, you know, like you can tell. Well, like,
if we want to talk about the language, I'm curious. I'm not as well versed as you, but were they going through something in the 19th century where they were hearkening back to the King James English?
Well, that was the whole Romantic period, right? And the Romantic period was named directly after the Romances, right? Like that's how it started. That's how even the term started. I was reading Owen Barfield on this, and the term Romantic was taken up by these poets. Originally, it was sort of a disparaging term, you know. It's like these poets who were too impressed by the wild landscapes and the supernatural side to the old medieval romances, right? But then it was taken up positively by another set of poets, especially Coleridge, Wordsworth, and then onward, and that's when the Romantic movement started, right? And it started as kind of this cult of the Middle Ages, right? So hearkening back to the Middle Age romances and this sort of recreating those feelings in a deeper way, you know, like in a deeper imaginative way. And so Tennyson is kind of, I don't know if you call him second or third generation romantic. If you call Coleridge and Wordsworth first and then Shelley and Keats second, and then maybe, Tennyson comes after, right?
Well, Tennyson's at the same time as like Wagner, who's also interested in the exact same stuff.
Yeah, and so this whole wave of interest in Arthurian literature, especially Wagner, and then Tennyson also, and then the Pre-Raphaelites within art and also poetry, but especially in art, there's all these paintings at that time of things that happen in the Arthurian literature. But this all inspired people like Jesse Weston, who we've been talking about a lot, like all these scholars who got interested in studying Arthurian literature, right? And then and then their research in turn inspires like and influences the modernists like T.S. Eliot and Yeats and Pound and all those guys, right? I wanted to check out Parzival by Wagner, but I didn't get a chance to do that. No. But that would go well with this.
It would. Wagner wrote about Tristan and Isolde also, and then I think with Lohengrin. That's probably
the Swan Prince.
Somehow related to.
That's supposed to be what, like Percival's son or something, according to
Tristan? Right.
So it's interesting. So the Romantic period is sort of this resurgence of this sort of deep interest in these old romances. It's kind of like the return of chivalry in a certain way, you know. Whereas before that, the period before that, even within poetry, there's this praise of like before that would be like 18th century stuff, like around the setting time of Mason and Dixon, right? Like where it's more like reason is the lady, reason is the one that they celebrate, right? And you find that in the French Revolution, even in the American Revolution, and this idea that that nature has to match with reason, right? And then the romantic reaction to that is that no, there's a deeper imaginative wild nature out there, and then that's reflected in the romances, and especially the supernatural side of them.
Well, there's an interesting link from the German maybe they're called idealists, the ones that were in Jena, and they kind of developed this idea of freedom. But like Novalis, he was like pre-romantic, and so a lot of their work kind of influenced the Wordsworth or Coleridge, you know, like they were translating.
Sturm und Drang.
Sturm und Drang.
Und Drang, yeah. Isn't Goethe like associated with that and Schelling?
Yeah, he was like the godfather of those guys.
Right.
And Schiller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right. And that's sort of the lineage is the Germans basically took these ideas seriously. This is according to Owen Barfield, right? Took these ideas of the imagination and romanticism, and they took these ideas and sort of expanded them philosophically. And then it sort of went back to Britain, and then Coleridge took it up in a big way and really expanded in English, the idea of what the imagination is and how it's different than the idea of fancy, and how the true poet is a creator in the same sense as God is a creator, right? It's sort of a reflection of God. This deep sense of the imagination that in the 19th century, in the 18th century wasn't really there.
Yeah.
But, so you can find that in Tennyson, you know, that sort of like stronger sense of the imagination, but it's but still it's a bit faint. Like it's way different, for example, if you read the Mabinogion, where it's like the Mabinogion is especially the earliest parts of that, it's full on metamorphosis. Like it just, things change. It's just a completely magical realm that you're within, right? Mm-hmm. But Tennyson still has to sort of conform to a kind of scientific, materialist, rationalist view of the world. So even though the supernatural element is there, it's not as strong as even in Mallory, right?
He does like give Merlin a lot of credit for setting things up, but I don't know that he's as supernatural as he is in other places.
That's what I really like about this book is that, like I said before, is how there's a through line to it that you can follow easily, right? And you don't like you said, there's no jousts and tournaments and all kinds of these other side quests and things that happen. It's just like, it's this slow build up or slow actual decline of what Arthur is trying to set up, right? This sort of perfect kingdom that Arthur's starting to set up, and then the seduction of Vivian, the seduction of Merlin by Vivian, right? And the capture, the magical capture of him in the oak tree.
And I think she was named Nimue.
Nimue, yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently, like, yeah, she's a fairy, right? So this fairy or elf connection also, right?
Well, there's a whole bunch of ladies of the lake with various names, but yeah.
Even Morgan Le Fay. Le Fay is, of course, fairy, right?
Yeah.
Supposed to be Arthur's sister, right? So this, and then the fact that he ends up being taken by the three queens to Avalon, basically to Elfland, at the end.
Well, so we could go through each of the 12 just to kind of give people a sense of the journey. But then I read somewhere that maybe they're written in such a way that they can stand completely on their own.
Yeah, you know, I think so. Yeah.
Like they're self-contained.
Right. Yeah, this idea, eyebills, yeah.
And you could mix them almost like a pack of cards and it would still be okay. But you're celebrating that through line. But the first one is Arthur. The old order changeth, yielding place to new. I wrote that down. I'm not sure why.
The coming of Arthur is the first one. Huh?
Uh-huh.
And then that follows. It's interesting, right? It starts with
Gareth and Lynette.
Yeah, that's a bit after, right? But the first one, right?
Coming of Arthur.
It starts with King Uther, but then they get into what it's actually. It starts with the very first line is the very first word is Leo Dogran, who's the father of Guinevere. So it starts with Guinevere. So that shows right from the beginning what this is. What this whole thing is going to be about. It's about Guinevere, right? The relation of Guinevere with Arthur. But then it talks about Uther a little bit. But the other thing is that if you don't read it all the way through, you miss certain parts, right? Like, so right from the beginning, it doesn't tell exactly how Arthur was born at the beginning, right? Like how he was adopted by Merlin and all of that part. Like that's not explained until I forget when, maybe in, I forget which other book it explains that, but there's certain things like that. There's these flashbacks all the way through that, if you wanted to piece together the entire story, you would have to read all of them. So the first one, the coming of Arthur, is about all the lords who basically reject Arthur's claim to be the king. And that's partly because he was, in this story, he's not even brought up by Uther at all. Uther's already dead, and Arthur, of course, is being adopted by somebody else, by Merlin first, and then somebody else, right? The father of Kay, I guess. But then there's all these petty kings.
Was it Lot? Is that his name?
Yeah, maybe.
Like and he was, in this he was work, one of them. I don't know.
And so then there are all these petty kings, like Carados, Urien, Cradlemont, Claudius, Clarions, Lot of Orkney. Yeah, Lot of Orkney. No, so it wouldn't have been Lot, yeah. I think Lot is
maybe that's
he's the father of I forget. Yeah. He's
it would be good to have genealogies for each work before we start.
I know, yeah. And so the genealogies kind of change slightly too, right? So it's
right. And so you kind of have to see which characters develop or be like who they like are renamed or you know, morph into in different works.
Yeah. So then all these petty kings go against Arthur's claim. And basically he has a battle and beats all of them. And they all accept him as their sovereign. And then, this, the father of Guinevere basically eventually accepts Arthur as eligible for her, for his daughter to marry. But he also finds out that about Arthur's sort of magical background, right? Like that he was taken by Merlin, and that he was raised by in part by Merlin, and then in part by that other king. And then he gets married to Guinevere. So that sets up the whole marriage of Arthur and Guinevere.
In terms of with Mallory sometimes there was a lot. It was densely packed, and if you weren't paying strict attention, you would miss details. This one is similar but different, because you still have to have like a different kind of focus, because there is this kind of language barrier where it's poetic language and it is straightforward, but you have to tune into it or else it just kind of washes over you.
Yeah, I found that if I read it out loud, especially when I was alone and I could just go off and be as dramatic as I wanted, you know, then it makes a lot more sense. Like, then you can get right into what's going on. But if you try to read it silently, it's harder. But if you read it out loud, for one, you start to notice the beauty of the language a lot more too, right?
Right.
There's a sort of musical quality to it. But then it also helps to understand what's going on a lot, you know. A lot. Speaking of Lot, yeah, Lot is the father of Gareth, which means he's also the father of Gawain. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, there, that's where I was getting that from.
Yeah.
Which is the second tale. Gareth is the kitchen boy.
And Lynette.
And so the second and third tales are kind of set up where, you know, there's models of what kind of ladies where. So the third tale, Geraint and Edind.
Yeah.
Comes out of the Mabinogion.
It comes out of the Mabinogion, but it's also in Cretchen, right? Like, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I wanted to look that up also, is how much different it is from Cretchen. Because, yeah, the edition of this book that I'm reading, it's making, in the notes, it's comparing what Tennyson is saying as compared to what the Mabinogion is saying, right? But they're not making the comparison between Tennyson and Cretchen. So I'm not, and maybe he's closer to Cretchen. I don't know. He must have used Cretchen as a source also, but
I really dislike that story. Just because it irritates me. Because
you don't like Lynette?
No, that one's fine. Lynette is like, oh, she's kind of awful all the way through.
Oh, you mean Geraint? Yeah.
Yeah, where he suspects that she is unfaithful,
yeah,
or going to be unfaithful, and so then he marches her ahead, and then she saves his life a bunch of times, and she's always true to him, like she is the true woman.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing but I picked just, up on. Let's go ahead.
No, it's just so over the top and too much, and I just feel like they really wear her down in all the stories, all three of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing I picked up this time reading this version of that is that it fits into the overarching thing about Lancelot and Guinevere, because Gareth is, not Gareth.
Geraint.
Yeah, Geraint is concerned about is that he hears the rumors of Guinevere being unfaithful to Arthur, and he knows that Enid, who becomes because of his actions, she becomes one of Guinevere's closest maidens, I guess, right? He's worried that Guinevere's corruption has affected Enid, and now she's having an affair on the side, right? And so that's how Tennyson, I think Mallory does this too, but that's how Tennyson connects it up with this overarching story of the whole corruption within the court.
Corruption. It's interesting that you use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Because different people define that differently.
Yeah.
What do you think corruption means in King Arthur's court?
Well, yeah, maybe another word would be decadence, I guess, or something like that. Like it's not corruption in the sense of like monetary corruption. And I guess that's sort of a more modern take on that word corruption. But it's corruption in a more basic sense of things degrading, things falling apart, right?
Well, okay, so at its root, right, corrupt. Like,
yeah.
It's like rotting.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's what Tennyson is saying. Like, it's sort of this moral corruption, or even deeper, this is spiritual corruption.
But when we think about, like, political corruption, we're thinking about
scandals and like bribing and all these things, like, yeah, mostly it's financial
above the law,
right?
Or
yeah,
like self-dealing.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's not in that sense, like, they're not, yeah, Lancelot is not betraying Arthur in that sense at all, you know. He's perfectly loyal to Arthur otherwise, but he's just fallen in love with Guinevere and he can't stop himself, right? And it's interesting, Tennyson is making a parallel. This is another thing that comes up with Tennyson, is that he's making a parallel with Guinevere and Lancelot, and then Tristram and Isolde, right? In a way that I hadn't seen before in Mallory. Maybe it's there, but Arthur has Lancelot take Guinevere and bring her to his court to be married, right? And Lancelot is the one who retrieves Guinevere first, right? And then later on, I think it's in the Guinevere chapter, I can't remember where it is, but Guinevere has this flashback of how beautiful that was this day in May, and how like paradise the nature was that they were riding through, and how they talked together so easily, her and Lancelot. And then when she finally met Arthur, how kind of cold and perfect he was, right? And that's the same thing, similar thing as what happens with King Mark sends Tristram over to Ireland to bring Isolde back.
Right.
And then they fall in love on the way back, right?
I mean, they do drink a love potion together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you get the idea that it's like nature itself at that time,
right?
With Lancelot and Guinevere, like it was nature itself was the enchantment, right? Like the beauty of it. But it's interesting. So what the corruption is, if we want to call it corruption, right? And it is maybe a wrong word, because it's like, isn't that true love? Like isn't that the ideal of courtly love?
The ideal, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what's more true?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, because that is something, there's a differing viewpoint about the idea of corruption around the supporters or the people who disagree with Trump. And so one side thinks corruption has to do with law, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so Trump is corrupt because he doesn't believe in the law. But another side thinks corruption has to do with identity, and mm-hmm. Trump can do whatever he wants because he's redeeming our fallen identity.
Right, yeah.
And so
He's cutting out the corruption within the system, right?
Because he's redeeming the idea of who we are. And I think we've talked about this before, this idea of democracy and like, who are the people, you know,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
and the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th feel like democracy failed in that it wasn't serving the people anymore if it wasn't a reflection of who they think, you know, the true identity is.
Right, right.
I don't know. It kind of I may have sidetracked us. I'm sorry, but it's interesting because you kept speaking about corruption, and so it is somehow related to what you're talking about with Lancelot, Arthur, and Guinevere, where his fidelity, Guinevere's fidelity, was like, it was the corruption is her infidelity, but then. Yeah. The corruption on the other side is this idea that the true love was more true between Lancelot and Guinevere.
Yeah, yeah. So it's sort of like it's a clash of two ideals, really, right? So Arthur has this ideal of the round table and how the round table and the fact that it's round, right? Everybody meets there as equals. There's no head of the table. Like Arthur doesn't sit at the head of the table. So they meet basically as equals. And so that's kind of a democratic ideal in a sense that it's still nobility, right? But it's closer to democracy than a kind of like autocratic king or whatever, right? But he has this ideal that the round table, through its laws of chivalry, which are restated in this book, right, that the knights of the round table can use these really high moral ideals to reform the land and put the land to right. Yeah. So that's his ideal. But it's almost too perfect. And he's described as almost too perfect. Yeah. Like coldly perfect. And then on the other hand, at the same time, you have this ideal of courtly love, right? Which is like beyond the bonds of marriage, right? If the love is pure enough, it becomes spiritual. And so these two things are clashing all the way through the romances, right? And then I guess there's a third in the mix too, which is the Holy Grail, right? Which is, the Holy Grail is almost beyond both of those things, right? It's not the ideal society, and it's perfect love beyond this idea of courtly love, right? Yeah, I don't know. I think that if we explore that, I think that gets to the heart of what the romances are all about, actually.
It's true.
All right, we'll call that 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us. You've been listening to 42 Minutes, Seasonal Book Club, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, to check out past shows or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, check out others. It's currently all the SyncBook Radio archives are free. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com. Thanks so much. But then the times grew to such evil that the holy cup was cut away to heaven and disappeared. Did I ever really need you? You're someone that I could love.